Welcome. You're listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. I'm Ron Fraser. Someone recently asked one of the Baha'i podcasters how the Baha'is see the world of the future. This is something that, for some reason, I've spent a fair bit of time thinking about. There isn't a clear picture of the future in our scriptures, but there's enough to give a little food for thought, as they say. So this podcast is just some ideas of mine that have been rattling around in my head for the last 20 years or so. I started thinking about the future of mankind while living for 4 years on a small island in the Caribbean. 18 months of that time was spent in a small wooden house in a farming village in a quite poor part of the island. Island life was a lot less romantic than I expected. You can't hide anything on an island. Everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And people have pretty much given up trying to hide their animal natures. I saw examples of many things that are holding mankind back. I saw the rich exploit the poor. I watched the poor spending their money in ways that made them even worse off. Well, I don't want to depress you with all the sad things I saw. My point is that it got me thinking about the parts of human civilization that would have to change. The enlightened culture that we could achieve, and the ideas in the Baha'i writings that can help mankind to move from the past to the future. The most important question is, I suppose, whether there is a future. Some people today are expecting most of us to be wiped out in Armageddon, while Christians will either live on in an earthly paradise or be whisked away to heaven, leaving the rest of us behind. Our answer to that is, in a word, metaphor. All the verses in the Bible that are currently used to frighten people are meant as a metaphor to suggest the conflict in each person and in groups of people as they struggle with the coming of a new messenger of God. Baha'is believe that Christ has returned in the glory of God, Baha'u'llah, the messenger of God for today. We believe that he brought a set of teachings that represent God's will for uniting the planet. So the Battle of Armageddon has been happening for the last 160 years. The heaven on earth spoken of by Jesus in the Lord's Prayer is being created, not in a sudden flash, but by people slowly becoming aware of this new message and making it a part of their lives. As one Baha'i t-shirt says, uniting the world one heart at a time. We expect God's will to be done. In fact, God seems to be fairly insistent on his will being done. Before we consider the future, let's look at recent history. If we compare today with 160 years ago, we're immediately struck with the drastic changes, the significant progress that mankind has made. In 1844, war was the normal method of solving international conflict. Today, war is still common, but it isn't considered rational behavior. Women weren't educated anywhere as a rule in 1844, but today women are approaching equal opportunity in education. International communication was by sailing ships until around 1900. Today, we have the internet. Hardly anyone spoke two languages in 1844 because they would never travel or meet anyone from another country. Human rights was an unknown concept, and slavery was pervasive. So we can see that mankind began to make tremendous scientific and social progress in the early 1800s, and that progress is continuing. Consider the formation of the European Union and how impossible that was just 70 years ago. France and Germany are friends and allies. America and Russia are allies and becoming friends. International unions are developing in Africa and Southeast Asia. The world is learning cooperation. With this rapid progress in mind, let's look ahead a little bit. What I expect to happen during the next 200 years is a rapid increase in both international cooperation and communication. Throughout the period, there will be strong negative forces attempting to slow progress and positive forces seeking to improve the lives of all the inhabitants of the planet. These negative forces are generally either old hatreds between groups of people or the conservative attitudes of the powerful as they try to hold on to their power. Nevertheless, the positive forces will win. From the Baha'i writings, we see that mankind's future is glorious. We are entering into an age that will be molded by universal communication and by universal education. Today's the day for the maturity of mankind. Our long childhood and adolescence are over. It's time to talk like adults, understand each other's point of view, and compromise. After we get over the shock and awe of actually talking to each other as intelligent people, as opposed to squabbling like small children, then mankind will begin to make significant and rapid progress in all areas of human society. My wife pointed out to me that 500 years ago, the various continents were isolated from each other, that each culture and religion assumed that they were superior to all the others who were looked upon as barbarians if they knew about them at all. Now we have instant communication throughout the planet, but the residue of the previous ignorance is still there. This residue causes Christians to think they have all the truth, and Muslims to think they have all the truth. She suggested that their xenophobia is an ignorance that will eventually be eliminated through education and communication. I don't think it's possible to overestimate the effect that our ignorance of each other's culture has had on our relationships. Much of the horror of the last few centuries has been due to two factors: a sense of racial or ethnic superiority combined with improved weapons. We can't do anything about the weapons. We're not likely to go back to swords and bows and arrows, but the planet will become one country with one human race that will operate like the members of one family. This is God's will, so it's going to happen in time. I believe that man is created noble and is willing to live by the golden rule once his fears are brought down to a reasonable level. God said, quote, "Noble have I created thee, yet thou hast abased thyself," end quote. Baha'is don't believe in original sin. The 18th chapter of Ezekiel says that the sins of the Son are not the sins of the Father, and the sins of the Father are not the sins of the Son. And while it's true that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, that doesn't say we aren't born noble. It just says we're not perfect. If God only loved perfect people, he wouldn't love anyone I know. So you are a noble creation that is loved by God, as are all of us. So even if we are noble and we believe other people are noble, we can still cause a lot of trouble if we operate from fear. Jerry Jampowski, a psychiatrist, wrote a book called Love is Letting Go of Fear. In it, he says that all of psychiatry is just love and fear. In every problem, you need to increase love or decrease fear. The two are antagonistic to each other. So let's explore ways to eliminate the fear that seems to dominate world politics and world economics. A primary fear that has weakened many cultures, including our own, is that there isn't enough stuff to go around. This fear permeates individuals, groups, and countries. Resources do become scarce if we waste them through greed or stupidity. It's been said that if the consumption of wood in America on a per-person basis had continued unchanged from 1607 to today, that there wouldn't be a tree left in the country. Why do we still have trees? Because we changed. We found other ways to build our homes and to heat them. And we will in the future change other parts of our lives so that we don't waste our oil, air, water, and land resources. Buckminster Fuller, the great visionary engineer, said that there was plenty of stuff to go around, but we would have to engineer our way out of this consciousness of scarcity. All right, let's assume for a moment that we were able to do that. Once you no longer have a consciousness of scarcity, a subtle change in economics takes place. A huge factor in economics is the level of fear or confidence in the future. Let's take a look at how it might affect your decisions. Imagine that you've been offered a job and you're talking to your new employer about salary. I want you to imagine yourself in two different life situations, one very confident and one very fearful. First, imagine that you are living in a nice home that's been left to you by your favorite aunt, and the new job is within walking distance. The second situation is that you're living in your 20-year-old car that barely runs, and the housing for miles around your new job is very expensive, and there's no public transportation. How would that affect your salary requirements? How would your uncertainty and fear figure into the salary you ask for the second scenario? What we have today is fearful people asking too much money for goods and services so that they can have enough money to protect themselves from all the horrible things that could happen to them. This creates an inflationary spiral because everything becomes more expensive, which of course creates more fear. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote that in the future, a person would only have to work a few hours a day to support their family. Part of this might be that people would live simpler lives, but it suggests a change to a more relaxed, confident attitude about life. Imagine the change in our family life, even if both parents chose to work, when the parents have adequate time to spend with their children. Today, many people are working long hours, sometimes with multiple jobs, leaving little time for the training of their children. Working women today are stressed out, trying to have a career and a family. I can imagine a mother working 4 hours in the morning and being quite happy and relaxed, knowing that her husband is caring for the children and that she'll be with them in the afternoon while her husband goes to work. It would be difficult today to create the economics or the confidence in the future for her to work that way. Why is it so difficult? I believe it has to do with the basic structure of our societies. I think I understand the problem, but I don't have a solution other than for people to obey the principles of the Baha'i faith, and through living those principles, the solution will be found. A problem in the basic structure, a problem that was created by the centralization of the industrial age, is that we move vast quantities of people and stuff around the planet. Huge ships are hauling automobiles, appliances, and oil in a frenzy of consumption. Thousands of cars clog the streets of each of our cities as people go to and from work. We've progressed beyond the need to do this on such a large scale, yet we still keep doing it. The answer isn't bigger ships and more highways. We have to really look at the basic structure of human society and what will really work in the long run. Again, I don't know how to fix this problem, but I believe the solution will emerge over the next few hundred years. Obviously, there will always be some movement of people and materials. But something is obviously wrong if you're spending so much energy moving people and materials on this scale. The people and materials are just in the wrong place. Have the people live close to their jobs and create and sell products closer to the people. Doesn't that sound right? Someone once said, if what you're doing doesn't work, don't do it harder. Well, we seem to just keep doing it harder. We keep concentrating our populations in smaller areas instead of using our communications networks to distribute the population over larger areas. Now, it's easy for me to say that we'll put the people and the jobs closer together, but that's not easy to fix. Do you move the people to the jobs or the jobs to the people? Sort of a chicken and egg problem. Another aspect of the economy that Buckminster Fuller wrote about was that we need for products to last longer. We can't buy cars, appliances, and even houses every few years and throw the old ones away. This consumes too much money and resources. Part of this is inevitable. due to the rapid changes in technology, but some is avoidable. We just need to be aware of the basic problem and work slowly toward a solution rather than making it worse. This lust for expensive toys causes part of the basic structural problem too. Mankind needs to understand that it is the family and other human relationships that basically make people happy. What we call work only becomes truly meaningful to the extent that it supports our family and the other important relationships in our life. I believe that when people in the economy understand their need for relationships, when they feel that their work is supporting those relationships, and that their income is secure, then a profound change will take place in the way people spend money. I don't think they'll be so attracted to the latest toys, the latest clothes, or other fads. I have to emphasize that a vibrant economy is good for society. Spending is good, growth is good, but our fears create a desire for excessive spending and excessive growth. If I buy stock in a company and then insist on a 10 or 15% annual return on my investment, I put a pressure on the company that will force it to make short-term decisions that might hurt it in the long run. A lack of long-term planning is another part of this basic structural problem. There was a practice among the Native Americans to make decisions based on a single question: what is best for the next seven generations? In most corporations, the question is, what's best for the next 6 months? The difference is fear. The officers of any company would probably love to plan long term, but they'll lose their jobs if the stock doesn't perform quarter after quarter. These people will be out the door if the price of stock drops or if the dividend is weak. They're afraid to look out seven generations. That's 140 years. How do you justify closing a factory and sending the production overseas, throwing your workers out of a job? The only justification is stock price and dividends. All other criteria are negative, especially to the worker who's now flipping hamburgers somewhere. Perhaps the future world we'll have more villages and fewer cities. You know, cities are a pretty recent phenomenon. We built many of our cities during the Industrial Age, the 1800s and early 1900s, because we needed lots of people for the factories. But we don't need thousands of people showing up at a factory each morning, so we probably don't need cities either. China is experimenting with clusters of towns connected by high-speed transportation and communication systems. This kind of exploration of alternate societal structures over time will uncover new ways of living that have all the benefits of modern living but with the quality of life of a village. Perhaps the biggest question that dominated the 20th century was whether communism with state ownership and central control, or capitalism with private ownership and limited or no control by the government, was the correct model for an economy. The Baha'i writings say that neither of these, in their present form, is correct. I suggest that once the fear is removed, or partially removed, and mankind has a spiritual basis for societal structures, then this question goes away. We certainly don't want a centrally controlled communist state, but there's nothing wrong with small groups, perhaps a village, creating a communal organization within a country that has a free market economy, as they do in Israel with the kibbutzim. On the other hand, we certainly don't want multinational corporations raping and pillaging the planet either. But that kind of behavior should go away with a stronger spiritual foundation and perhaps some changes to the laws governing corporations. And even if it doesn't, the world government structures will easily guide the corporations to more beneficial and socially responsible behavior. Companies exist to benefit the communities in which they operate. Human beings are not raw materials that can be consumed for the benefit of corporations. In the last 3 or 4,000 years, there has been a racism in which one racial group has created businesses that exploited other racial groups for the benefit of the owners of the business, and sometimes for the benefit of its customers. This racist behavior on the part of businesses obviously has to change. My assumption is that as the enlightenment created by the new message from God sweeps over the planet, more and more businesses will naturally abandon the racist behavior, and the customers of the other businesses will demand that they change too. So let's look at a world government for a few minutes. It might surprise you to learn that the Baha'i Faith quietly holds elections every year for 17,000 local and 185 national councils called spiritual assemblies. Every 5 years, the International Council, referred to as the Universal House of Justice, is elected. These elections are held with almost no cost because there is no nominations, no electioneering, no speeches. We simply come together, pray, then vote. The 9 people who get the most votes are elected to these councils, and everyone else breathes a sigh of relief. You see, the difference between a Baha'i election and the elections in America or Europe is no one wants to be elected in a Baha'i election. There's a Native American saying, if a man wants to be chief, you know he isn't fit to be chief. That's the way it is with Baha'is. It's a lot of work to be on one of these assemblies. As an individual on an assembly, you have no power. There's no applause. No one will attempt to bribe you so that you vote in their favor. The assemblies act only as a group. If you're elected to an assembly, you don't represent the people who voted for you. I'm going to repeat that. If you're elected to an assembly, you don't represent the people who voted for you. Your only job is to consult with the other 8 people on the assembly and try to determine God's will in every question. It's a form of government that is liberated from all negative influences, except for our own human failings that we all bring to the table. But if we follow the rules of Baha'i consultation, even these are minimized. Eventually, this form of government will sweep over the planet as the populations demand it. It just works so much better. This is real democracy. At each election, everyone is eligible to be elected. A ballot is a blank piece of paper. You write in all 9 names. Interesting, eh? A huge question in the 20th and the 21st centuries is militarization and the role of superpowers. Baha'u'llah makes it clear that each country is to have a military that is only sufficient for its internal order. Then if one country attacks another, all the other nations will unite to defeat the aggressor. If we do this, then there won't be an unfair burden on the taxpayers of any one country. The perceived need for militarization goes back to the idea of scarcity and the fear we talked about earlier. If we believe that we have adequate resources and we aren't afraid of running out, then why slaughter our young men and women as they try to slaughter people in our neighboring countries just so we can steal their resources? In the future, the concept of justice for all the inhabitants of the planet will permeate all aspects of civilization. I did a text search on the word justice in the Baha'i writings and found almost 11,000 entries in 500 documents. God has told us, quote, the best beloved of all things in my sight is justice, end quote. In 1919, Abdu'l-Bahá wrote in his letter to the Central Organization for a Durable Peace, quote, among the teachings of His Holiness Baha'u'llah is justice and human rights. Until these are realized on the plane of existence, all things shall be in disorder and remain imperfect. The world of humanity is a world of oppression and cruelty, and a realm of aggression and error. These manifold principles, that is, the principles of the Baha'i Faith, which constitute the greatest basis for the felicity of mankind and are of the bounties of the merciful, must be added to the matter of universal peace and combined with it, so that results may accrue. Otherwise, the realization of universal peace by itself in the world of mankind is difficult. As the teachings of His Holiness Baha'u'llah are combined with universal peace, they are like a table provided with every kind of fresh and delicious food. Every soul can find at that table of infinite bounty that which he desires. If the question is restricted to universal peace alone, the remarkable results which are expected and desired will not be attained. End quote. What Abdu'l-Bahá is saying is that we must combine all the teachings of Baha'u'llah with the concept of universal peace in order for peace to be possible. It isn't enough just to say, "I will be just," or "we will have peace." That must be combined with justice, with the elimination of prejudice, with the equal status of women, and personal qualities like humility and reverence, service to mankind, the list goes on and on. But far from being impossible, Baha'is see this as inevitable, as God's will, which will be eventually manifested in human societies everywhere. It's up to you and me to determine how much suffering occurs before justice and peace finally prevail. Let's talk a minute about justice. This word justice is not the punishing of criminals. It's the search for truth before making a decision. And part of that truth will be the equal rights of each party. The golden rule will apply in every decision, every time. Justice will no longer be the powerful imposing their will on the powerless. Perhaps this is one of the meanings of "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." And speaking of equal rights, a huge change that is taking place now is the increase in the status of women. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, quote, "The male and female are like the two wings of a bird, and when both wings are reinforced with the same impulse, the bird of humanity will be enabled to soar heavenward to the summit of progress," close quote. Not only has mankind not benefited up to now from the full contribution that the women of the past were capable of, but since men were forcefully keeping women in a subservient position, even the capacity of men was reduced by the expenditure of this negative energy. If you have two people pushing against each other, each with 100 pounds of force, there will be no result except that energy is wasted. If both people push in the same direction, then you have a 200-pound force and you can get a lot of work done. In the future, women will participate equally in science, education, government, and the arts. We are told that when women participate in government, wars will be less likely because women are less inclined to send their sons and daughters off to fight and die. Let's look at education. In most parts of the world, education is still modeled after schools 1,000 years ago, when there was an intellectual elite who would make up the lawyers, doctors, and priests. The teacher would lecture, and the students would emulate the teacher. In our scripture, God says that, quote, "Lack of a proper education has deprived man of that which he doth inherently possess, that man is," quote, "a mine rich in gems of inestimable value," and that, quote, "education alone can cause it to reveal its treasures," end quote. Abdu'l-Bahá said that all children must be educated, but in extreme cases where that is impossible, the girls must be educated before the boys. Now, the reason is that they are the first educators of the children. We are beginning to understand the importance of the very first years of life in the formation of character. If mankind is to create an ever-advancing civilization, as it says in the Baha'i writings, it is critical that great attention be given to character education of small children, generation after generation. What will education be like in the future? I can only guess that we will find better ways of bringing the gems out of the students. There was a brilliant Baha'i educator named Dan Jordan who was working with some troubled, delinquent youth. Dan said they were very poor academically. Dan could have told them to take out their math books and turn to page one, but what he did was to start where they were. He talked to them about their interests. The boys wanted to do martial arts, so they started with that. After a while, they hit a plateau, so they talked about what could improve their performance in these martial arts. They learned about nutrition and meditation. Then over time, as the boys became more serious about their lives and started to see possibilities for their future, he started to teach them academic subjects. There's some kind of lesson in this story. I'm not an educator. I only know how I've learned myself. It's mostly been on my own with smarter people, removing obstacles from my path from time to time. I can imagine students working on group projects, doing research on the internet, for example, and assisted by a teacher who facilitates the process. If the students are teaching themselves, then it takes a tremendous burden from the teacher. I'm sure some smart people will find some way of teaching that doesn't leave the teachers exhausted and the students frustrated or bored. Hey, maybe in the future teachers will make more money than baseball players. What a concept. Well, I've shared some of my thoughts and fantasies over the last 20 years. Don't take any of this as gospel unless I was quoting directly from the writings. The safest thing to do is to go on the internet or to your library and read these wonderful writings for yourself. One of the principles of our faith is the independent investigation of the truth, which you'll find in the writings of Baha'u'llah. I recommend that for further information on the future of the planet, you go to www.baha'i.org and click on a link called A Global Vision. A Global Vision in the center of the first page. You'll find several articles on the future. Dear friends, please write to us. This would be so much easier if you ask questions or suggest topics rather than for us to guess what you're thinking. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast and to other Baha'i podcasts. It's a joy to be of service to you. And remember, you're welcome to join us at any time.
You've been listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. If you'd like to learn more about the Baha'i faith, call 1-800-22-UNITE or in Florida call 850-543-2129. Look on the internet at www.baha'i.org for the international site or www.baha'i.us for the U.S. site. Remember that Baha'i is B-A-H-A-I. In Florida, our website is www.EmeraldCoastBaha'is, that's with an S at the end, .org, EmeraldCoastBaha'is.org. You can email me at panhandlebaha'is@aol.com. Thanks for listening.